All living things need to eat, but only Homo sapiens cook, and how we cook has understandably evolved and grown more sophisticated over the 2.5 million years of human history. In a time of nonstick skillets, automatic espresso machines, digital meat thermometers, and high-speed blenders, you can only imagine how early humans got along without pots to cook in or forks to eat with. So for this week's Please Explain, we thought that we would find out when and how our basic cooking tools were invented. Bea Wilson joins us now from Cambridge, England. She is the author of Consider the Fork, A History of How We Cook and Eat. It's been made available in a paperback edition from Basic Books. Hello, welcome to our show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And we invite our listeners to join the conversation. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692 or write us on our show page at WNYC.org. Also on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. So, Bea, I'm assuming that at first humans just threw foods that they wanted to cook on a fire. Is there any archaeological evidence for how the earliest humans cooked their food?
Well, there are all kinds of traces. I mean, actually, the thing that we forget that's so much older than fire is the knife. Cutting tools are really, I mean, it pleases me because it's the thing that chronologically comes first in the meal. It's the first thing that you do when you're going into the kitchen. You get out your chopping surface and your sharp tool, and it's the thing that in history came first. You know, as much as a million years before fire, people had these, all of these different sharp objects, and yes, they might have been just kind of flints and stones and various kind of weird spheroid things for kind of breaking down raw meat, but still it's a form of technology. So then about a million years after that, you get fire. And yes, there are, I mean, it's so hard to reconstruct how people were cooking. There are little traces of bones. There are traces of primitive hearths where we can just sort of imagine that people were gathering around the fire, much as we still congregate in our kitchens today. But it's pretty hard to reconstruct.
A listener is wondering about whether burls from trees were used as bowls pretty early, or whether gourds were used for as receptacles for food, or perhaps even to cook in.
Gourds were definitely used for a very long time and still are in some places in the world. Another precursor of pottery that's been suggested was shellfish, because after all, if you look at something like, well, people still eat mulmer in the air in France, and you kind of use the mussel as simultaneously a sort of miniature bowl and a form of fork, because it's so satisfying eating mussels when you're kind of picking each one out using the shell itself. But to me, it's not very plausible that you would get from the other obvious candidate would be things like turtles or larger forms of shellfish. But I think pottery was a real leap of invention. And it just seemed the mere fact that it took people so long to think of it shows that it was a piece of massive lateral thinking on the part of our ancestors to think that instead of just, roughly speaking, shoving something in the fire, you could protect it from the onslaught of the fire with clay and then water. And we know that it wasn't an obvious idea from the fact that in various places where archaeologists have dug up early pottery, let's say in Greece, there's this cave where for thousands of years people had pottery, and these were early farmers. They were growing things like pistachio nuts, legumes of various kinds, which would have been great cooked in pots. And yet, based on the archaeological remains, they were initially, for hundreds of years, just using the pottery for religious purposes. It was a decorative thing. And who knows, really, who the first brilliant person was who thought, actually, maybe we could use this miraculous substance for cooking. But whoever they were, I take my hat off to them, because I still think pots and pans are just where all good cooking starts. And for me, the invention of the pot around 10,000 years ago, which in historic terms, that's nothing compared to fire 2 million years ago. I mean, pots and pans are the greatest invention, because it's the point at which you move from just heating something up in a crude way to cuisine and the intermingling of flavors.
Pots were used for burials and things like that, but haven't people all over the world come up with the idea of making pottery independently of each other? We see it in
one of those
we see it in Asia, in the Middle East,
absolutely.
And then in the Americas.
It's happening in Japan, it's happening in the Middle East, it's happening in the Americas, and it's one of those strange things. It's a great idea that seems to have occurred to lots of people at roughly the same time.
When
concurrently
were
with the first right. moments of agriculture, which makes sense because there are all sorts of kind of staple starchy foods which couldn't really have been eaten at all without pots.
And then there are clay ovens. We still see them in India with the tandoor.
Yeah, which is a great sort of technology in that it combines convection and conduction to a much greater extent than Western bread ovens. And those sort of beehive ovens, which were used throughout Europe, but then kind of died out as other technologies took their place.
So do people use early pottery to both cook and to eat out of, or did the evolution develop slowly as, you say, the use of pottery did in general?
Yeah, I'm sure they would have used their early cooking pots for cooking and for eating. Just as, I mean, things like, and they would have been sort of probably shared out among a whole group of people, just as things like spoons in the early days were often communal. I mean, you'd have one spoon and you'd be kind of sharing it from mouth to mouth. And we think of wooden spoons as being something that we use for cooking with, but they used to be something that people ate with as well. But the sad thing is that because wood isn't such a durable material as metal, not very many wood eating spoons have survived.
Do we have any idea of why all these different cultures discovered the same idea that you could take clay and you could heat it and you could wind up with something that was useful for food? I mean, we have it, as I said, even in the Americas, in the American Southwest, the Anasazi were making pottery 1,500 years ago, much later than in Europe, but still separate from Europe.
Yeah, I mean, I think it does go along with the adoption of, as I say, of different foods, of starchier foods. I mean, if you're fundamentally living off a sort of hunter-gatherer diet of meat and nuts and berries, then fire's okay. You know, it's sort of primitive sort of barbecue. Whereas if you're growing staple crops for the first time, as farmers were around 10,000 years ago, around the same time that pots are becoming adopted, you really want to be able to boil those things for a long time. And there are certain sort of tubers and roots that people couldn't really eat at all until they were doing some sort of boiling. It has to be said there was a way of boiling without pottery, which is still used, again, in loads of parts of the world, such as people think of the Hawaiian luau maybe most, which is the pit ovens, where you just dig a huge pit in the ground and layer up hot rocks and leaves, and you can either then put in various sorts of vegetables or coconuts, or you can put a huge haunch of meat. And it's meant to be a fantastic way of cooking, except incredibly labor-intensive, and it's a communal sort of cooking. And I think with all these cooking technologies, we've always got to consider not just the way that the end product that we get, how delicious the meal is at the end, but it always goes along with all of these other social elements of how it fits together with the way people live.
I'm talking with Bea Wilson, who's the author of Consider the Fork, A History of How We Cook and Eat, now available in paperback from Basic Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And we invite your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org or also on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. When were the first metal pots and pans created?
Well, there are cauldrons, and I mean, if you look at Roman cookware, already by that point, it was not just metal, but it had reached a level of sophistication that wouldn't look out of place in kitchenware shops today. But I mean, essentially, you can trace the metals in cookware through the different ages: Bronze Age, bronze cookware; Iron Age, iron cookware, as you'd expect. But the Romans had beautiful frying pans. They had amazing colanders. They had cookware that was not just functional but beautiful. They had steamers. And the Victorians, which was another great era for cookware, often looked back to Roman times in envy at the sort of level that they had reached with their cookware. And then it was kind of a step backwards, as so often when we look at Roman history and then what happened subsequently in medieval times, it seemed as if the technology kind of regressed. And a lot of what was happening in medieval times was one-pot cauldron cookery. And it would be a huge investment to have a metal pot. People often left them in their wills. It was probably the most important possession in a way that a household would have if you didn't have much money. And an entire meal would be cooked in this single pot.
Weren't there problems sometimes? There were problems with lead poisoning, or when you're cooking with copper, there also are bad chemical interactions. And I know that even the ancient Greeks, Aristotle, one of his students, wrote about the problems that arise when wine is kept in copper.
There were all kinds of problems associated with metal. I mean, some of the problems with heavy metal in ancient times were, let's say, deliberate. They didn't realize the effect it was having, in that lead was added on purpose to wine, both as a preservative and because it has apparently the most delicious sweet taste. And so if you had a bad harvest and the wine came out sour, they would use lead as a corrective. And there are these whole sort of theories that you can trace the decline of the Roman Empire to the loss of fertility resulting from mass lead poisoning. That's probably a little bit far-fetched, but yes, returning to cooking pots, the problem of the surface was huge, and let your pans be frequently re-tinned is an instruction you often will see in recipes. And I think people probably didn't get their pans as frequently re-tinned as they should if cooks then were anything like as absent-minded as I know I am today. I mean, some people actively sought out the effects that an untinned copper pan would have, because when you boiled vegetables, particularly with something acidic, in an untinned copper pan, the thought was that it would go greener and that this was good, until people realized that they were actually poisoning themselves.
I'm talking with Bea Wilson. Her book, Consider the Fork, A History of How We Cook and Eat, inspired today's Please Explain segment. And we invite your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org, also on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. We'll take a little break, and we'll come back with more. And we'll be taking your calls and also reading off some of the things that you have written to us on our show page. Stay with us. And we are back with Bea Wilson. She's the author of Consider the Fork, A History of How We Cook and Eat. It is available in paperback from Basic Books, and it is the subject of today's Please Explain. A listener, Amadou from Harlem, asks about what the Egyptians did in terms of implements. How important were they?
And when I think of the Egyptians, I think of... That's a really good question. I think of bread ovens, I think of flatbreads, I think of basic cooking pots. But it's very hard to reconstruct. I mean, one of the earliest civilizations that we know something about is Mesopotamia, because the very earliest recipes on record are in these cuneiform tablets from Mesopotamia. And what I love about them is that, I mean, they're fairly basic in their instructions. It's not kind of chatty in a Julia Child fashion, as you'd imagine. But you can still somehow reconstruct that those cooks 4,000 years ago were doing something fairly similar to what we're doing now, in that they're all recipes for boiling stuff. And they'll sort of say, assemble the ingredients, and they're usually things like mutton, i.e. sort of lamb, leeks and herbs and sort of other seasonings. And it will always just say, assemble the ingredients, add water and toss into the pan and sort of cook until done. And I sort of think that's not so dissimilar to the way that some of us are still making stews and casseroles today.
Now, despite all the changes, weren't people still using their fingers to eat with until fairly recently?
They were. I mean,
and some cultures still prefer to eat with their hands.
Well, some cultures do still prefer to eat with their hands. And loads of places in India, people eat with their hands, in the Middle East. And as with any sort of technological advance in the realm of cooking and eating, the fork isn't necessarily a step forward. People who eat with their fingers say, you become very dexterous. There are things that you can do with your fingers which actually a fork prevents you from doing. And part of the reason why the book's called Consider the Fork is because there was this kind of prejudice against the fork for so long. It was only adopted in Italy for many years. it was adopted in Italy in the medieval times, whereas it took a long time to be accepted in Britain and elsewhere. And people thought forks were weird. Why would you want to put metal prongs into your mouth along with the food when you could do a perfectly good job of eating with a sharp knife, a spoon, and your fingers?
Raghu from Edison, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, sir. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question. When I was growing up in India, and my mom used to cook the food in mud pots, would that increase the taste, enhance the taste? I always used to think it tastes better.
What do mud pots mean? Were they fired?
My parents used to cook the food in the pots, you know, with the made out of clay.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, this is something I write about. I find this really interesting. This is something which I think has largely got lost, in that now when we consider a cooking pot, partly because of the concerns over toxicity that we were talking about earlier, we want the substance, which is largely metal in the West, to interact with the food as little as possible. Whereas in the past, and perhaps still in India, there was a sense that you would choose the clay which would give the food the most delicious taste. And I think that's an example of something that's almost dying out. I mean, you still get it in clay pot cooking in Thailand, in India. There are certain types of clay that are chosen, I think, for pickles and others for rice. That's a really good point.
But cast iron skillets also impart something into the food that you cook, don't they?
They do. They leach small amounts of iron into the food, which is great if you're anemic. But I think generally there's a sense, partly because we're so aware that some of the things coming out of metals could be the wrong kind of things or that we could get poisoned. I think there generally is a sense that we don't want to get anything from the pan. Wouldn't you say that's how most...
Well, I like the idea of cast iron imparting a little bit of iron into
my
system.
Yeah, and I love cast iron, and it's always been one of my favorite things to cook on. And then I was delighted to come across this piece of research from this engineer, Chuck Lemmy, who tried to look systematically at the question of what the ideal cooking pot would be and what substance it would be made from. In 1988, he looked at it, and he rated all kinds of different metals on his idealness rating. And he found out, which maybe we knew already, that there is no such thing as the ideal cooking pot, because the ideal pot would be both very thin and very thick at the same time, for example, because you want it very thick to have even heat distribution, but very thin so that it heats up fast.
Well, isn't copper considered one of the best conductors?
Copper's pretty good from some points of view, but it's not. What he found was that cast iron was actually the best single substance, but that if you wanted the ideal cooking pot, you'd have to come up with some sort of composite, which actually is the way that high-end cookware design has gone. But what I like about his research is he concluded that even if you sort of made a wonderful composite of aluminium and nickel and bits of copper and this and that, you'd still only rate somewhere over about 50% on the idealness rating, because some of the things we want from a pot are simply incompatible. And in the end, I think we just have to give up on the search for the ideal when it comes to the kitchen and settle with what we've got.
Well, we also have an enamel-coated pots and pans, and there's Teflon, which, as I understand it, was created by accident, a laboratory accident at DuPont in the late 30s, and now has been, well, I remember Nora Ephron once beginning a recipe with an instruction to preheat a Teflon pan until you see the carcinogenic fumes rising from it.
I love that. Yeah.
Well, go ahead.
Well, Teflon is, yeah, it's another example of we thought it was going to be a wonder pan. And I mean, if we just disregard the question of whether it's carcinogenic or not, you don't get those delicious crusty bits at the bottom. You actually want things sometimes to stick to a pan. When you're browning meat for a stew, you want a certain amount of stickiness. And I just think the problem with non-stick pans is they get progressively worse and worse as you use them. Whereas if you've got a kind of old battered aluminium omelette pan, as I have, that you season each time, each slick of oil that you put on it polymerizes a bit more and it gets slightly better with each use, and somehow you then develop a sentimental attachment to it as it blackens, whereas I have no sentimental feelings about Teflon.
Let's take a call from Helene from the Bronx. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I was just wondering wondering, how did people eat spaghetti before forks? I know in Asia they probably used chopsticks, but once it got to other countries, if they didn't have forks, how did they eat it? I just can't see how you could eat it with your hands.
That is the question. There are paintings depicting Italians eating pasta with their hands, but in a single word, the reason that Italians adopted the fork before anyone else was pasta. It, as you say, it's just such a wonderful implement for twirling around long noodles. What they had before the fork was a single pronged stick, much like a sort of large chopstick, called the, my Italian's not very good, punta ruole, forgive me if I've completely mispronounced that. And then there was a realization that if one prong was good, two prongs would be even better and three prongs better still. And that is fundamentally the reason that Italians loved forks before anyone else.
Well, let's talk about chopsticks for a moment. How did the Chinese come to invent chopsticks, and how long ago was it?
Chopsticks way predate the adoption of the knife and fork. It was in the Song Dynasty, so around 900 years, I mean, roughly, let's say, 1,000 years ago. And chopsticks, as with knives, as with forks, as with spoons, were made from many different substances. And there's a sort of problem now with the phenomenon of disposable chopsticks made from wood being a kind of ecological disaster. And there's a movement to bring back the idea of people carrying their own chopsticks, which I like because it's a kind of throwback to the days when everyone in Europe used to carry their own knife with them and utensils were a personal object rather than something that was just impersonally laid on the table for whoever happened to sit down.
Although knives were also considered dangerous in some cases.
They were, and there were good reasons why people stopped carrying knives. And in some ways, the foundation of all table manners was this fear that the person sitting next to you was going to pull their knife out at the table and use it on you. And part of the reason that we ended up with these rather useless objects, the blunt table knife, was precisely to deal with that fear and to manage that violence.
Were teaspoons first invented to stir tea?
Teaspoons were first invented to stir tea, but they're a sort of fascinating example of something that went from being something very precise and single function to being, I mean, I think one of the most delightfully multifunctional objects in the kitchen. In my own kitchen, I can never have enough teaspoons, and they're one of those things a bit like with kitchen scissors that endlessly somehow go missing because people take them to other bits of the house to use them for other things. And they serve every function, don't they, from measuring to just tasting a delicious sort of pre-taste of what you're going to have for dinner. And it's kind of interesting how something as specific as a teaspoon, which had its own particular context in the English tea rituals of the 18th century, could have then supplanted that context, whereas other things like Japanese bamboo tea whisks are still just used in that one setting.
When did measuring become standardized? Not everyone uses cup and teaspoon measurements. Are those measurements specifically American?
They're not specifically American, but there is a kind of fascinating history to and fro between the question of why the whole of the rest of the world pretty much weighs things on scales, whereas America measures things with cups. And there are various theories among historians. It used to be said that it must be a feature of pioneer life because it's so much easier to carry some tin cups with you on a wagon on the frontier trail than it would be to have some heavy scales. But that doesn't fully tell the whole story because if you look at early 19th century American recipes, a lot of them are using scales. And if you think of pound cake, which is a classic American recipe in the very earliest American cookbooks, that's obviously alluding to weight. And my theory for the reason that cups became the dominant form of measuring in America is really that Fanny Farmer was the first runaway best-selling cookbook. And she was devoted to cup measures, partly because she was someone who came very late to cooking. She was an invalid, and cooking was just something that she learnt in her late 20s, and it was a completely unexpected career for her. And she didn't feel very confident in the kitchen. And I think technologies are not just about how well they do a job. They're about how confident they make you feel. And I think judged by the sort of homeliness and ease of use, cup measures are great. When it comes to accuracy, I think, but I mean, I'm a British person, so I would say this, I think they're terrifying, that you can get this huge variation when you're baking a cake from one where you've packed the flour tight and it comes out great, and another time you've somehow sifted the flour a bit more and it doesn't work. But then American friends say, well, we use cups and it works just fine.
And some of us actually use scales. Rob from Pennsylvania called. He asked about early hunters cooking animals over a spit. But spits actually remained part of cooking into fairly recently because of people cooked over the hearth, didn't they?
People cooked over the hearth. Yeah, I mean, spit roasting was actually usually to one side of the fire. People picture it as being over the fire. But for true open hearth cookery, it was actually sort of to one side.
And during the Middle Ages, you say there were turnspit boys.
There were these turnspit boys. I mean, it's heartrending to think of these boys as young as five who are being employed to stand near the scorching heat of the fire and continuously turn a haunch of meat. And that's an example of something where great minds devoted themselves to the subject of how do you keep a haunch of meat continuously turning? Because the meaning of rotisserie is to turn. That's the crucial problem, so you don't get hot spots and scorching. And there were all of these sort of not-so-clever solutions, such as using young boys, and then people bred these special dogs called turnspit dogs who had especially short legs, and they ran around in dog wheels, which were then hooked up to the spit. And there were these terrible accounts of the dogs running away when they noticed that the meat was being prepared for dinner because they were sort of clearly intelligent enough to realize what was coming. And then later people created these brilliant devices, and I've seen them in action, these clockwork turnspits, which did the job just as well, but mechanically. And it's an example of one of these many blind alleys in the history of cooking, because they are absolutely wonderful devices. And I've been to the home of this food historian called Ivan Day, who still lives his life pretty much as if he were in the 17th century. And he cooks all his meat before an open hearth. And he says, these are just the best gadgets ever. They're so much better than a microwave. And on their own terms, they are, except that most of us don't now want to live around an open hearth.
Well, there's also more in most kitchens we'll find peelers, whisks, spatulas, sifters, cherry pitters, zesters, mushroom brushes, egg separators. Are those all fairly recent developments?
Some of them are and some of them aren't. I think there's a wonderful mix of old and new in our kitchens that sometimes we just take for granted and assume, because we've bought them all from the same modern kitchenware store, that they belong to the same stage in our development, but they don't. I mean, something like the sort of granite mortar and pestle that I have in my kitchen, it's very common, lots of people have them. That could easily be something from 10 or 20,000 years ago, whereas something like a decent vegetable peeler that does a good job of removing the skin from a carrot without hurting your hand in the process, that's something that's just 20 years old.
Do you have a favorite?
I do have a favorite. I like the Oxo Good Grips.
Well, they're fairly recent developments. We didn't get to seasoning pots and pans and why sometimes you don't want to wash them in soapy water. But listeners have been asking about that as well. I guess they're going to have to look at your book.
I guess they are.
B. Wilson's book is called Consider the Fork, History of How We Cook and Eat. It's now available in a paperback edition from Basic Books. And it has been the source of a lot of really interesting stories on today's Please Explain segment. Bea, thank you so much for being on our show today. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.